everybody. This is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Two guests this week. First up, ESPN's Adnan Virk, the versatile host of college football, college basketball, calls Major League Baseball, and is the host of his own podcast, Cinephile, also a fairly well-known Canadian, as he will tell you. In this podcast, Dave Revson follows Adnan Virk. He is the lead host of the Big Ten Network and had a really interesting career path and had a great career going at ESPN, made a leap in 2007 to this fledgling network and has never looked back and has become their lead face on what is a growing and really well-done network. So Adnan Virk of ESPN, Dave Revson of the Big Ten Network, coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, as we said at the top, we bring in Adnan Virk. He is one of the more versatile people at ESPN in terms of front-facing talent, college football host, college basketball host. He does play-by-play for baseball. You see him on ESPN Radio all over that company. And then he's also the host of his own podcast, Cinephile. And because we could not get a more famous Canadian, Renee Young, for this podcast, we now bring in Adnan Virk of ESPN.
Two words, Rich. Who canceled? All right. The last time we did this, there was much hullabaloo and much pomp and circumstance. And I made the effort to come down to New York. I was so excited to see you. Made a big day of it. Got to see Alan Kim, Bette Marsden. Now, this was a late ask by you. Otherwise, I'd be hanging out with you and Pellegrino. So I just want to know. Let's be candid here. Who canceled?
Yeah. By the way, Adnan, you were on the May 6th, 2016 edition. It's quite a memorable episode that was. it really wasn't about – I'm sure there's so many people out there racing to get to the their downloads now. Adnan, honestly, nobody canceled. I was in desperate straits. I was trying to figure out who could follow Carrie Champion. I really did not have any great ideas. And so – I looked at the first, went back on the guest list of the podcast. This is when we were doing it from the swimsuit closet. And and you were one of the early ones. So I was thinking to myself, maybe bring back Adnan. Dave Revson will also be part of this podcast. He has not been on, so that's good. But yeah, you are not filling in for anyone. It was more of desperation time. And so do I go to Rebecca Lowe? Do I go to Schefter, or do I go to Adnan
Virk? Jimmy Trina again. How many more round tables can we do? Like, that's the issue now. So I appreciate the honesty, because I thought to myself, remember last time I was petrified anybody was even going to listen. And then, incredibly, we set the record for downloads.
That's right. It was like,
and then I think McDonough then beat me the previous week. So for 1 week, I get to say I was the champ.
Yeah, it was. It was like crazy six-figure numbers, but I think, honestly, it was a little bit of a fugazi, as Al Pacino would say in one of your favorite movies. In that, I think we hit the front of Stitcher, and all you had to do was sort of click on the link, I think it counted as a listen. So I think got a little bit of the benefit on that.
No, because my friend Sean Cameron, the Puff Daddy, who was on the Rubber Boots podcast with our boy James Duffy, who you're now going to be just best friends with now that you're moving to Toronto. I can't wait for the Duffy stories. And Duffy was very generous. He mentioned me when he was on your pod. But yeah, he goes, how in the world? He goes, look at these numbers. It's like 25,000, 30,000, 100,000. Like, people actually want to listen to you? Like, that can't be possible. So totally we goose the numbers. And you have not heeded my advice, because the last time I said, please get my boy Max Bredos on. Max is now fleeing Bristol. He was sensational on the latest Cinephile, because he has impressions of Sean Connery, Richard Burton, Peter O'Toole. He's staying with ESPN, but he's going to do SportsCenter out there, and he's also going to be the face of LAFC. And one other request, if you can't get Mad Max, please get Adam Amin, who is a rising star in our industry. And I don't know if there's anybody, Rich, who just honestly feeds off of your material more than Amin. I think he must be clicking on every podcast, every article you write. He's very engaged with you. So please get one of those two. Joe Tess was fabulous. I'm glad you got Cassidy. They were both great. But get either Max or Amin, please.
Bredos would be excellent. He's obviously a soccer fan, and I wish him the best in his new role. Obviously, Adam Amin is terrific. He's been part of some roundtables. He absolutely is one of the really good young broadcasters at ESPN. The fact that he's using any of my material is sad. I would caution him against that. But Adnan, you've already had like seven name drops at this point, and so early in the podcast. Do you want to name drop Mark Gross or a Norby Williamson or a Connor Shell? You want to go exec name drop, or do you prefer the colleague name drop?
I prefer colleague name jokes, although as Joe Test, because Test listened to the one last time very avidly, and he said to me, you were not supposed to mention your agent. And then you and Deitch just blew the doors off of that. I said, well, that was more Rich. Once he barged down. But you mentioned my bosses. All they ever want to talk about is movies. I saw Stephanie Drewley yesterday, and she goes, hey, what do you think of The Shape of Water? She's telling me she thought it was beautifully shot, but thought the story's a little ludicrous. You mentioned Mark Gross. He liked Why Him with James Franco, Bryan Cranston. Patriots Day was a big fan of. Lee Fitting, my college boss, despises movies. He despises every time I mention movies. When Tess throws to the studio and says, back to our favorite cinephile, Adnan Virk, Fitting just he wants to strangle himself. He can't stand it. And listen, there are people in our industry, Rich, as you know, they love sports and they're diehard sports fans. That is Lee Fitting, who, of course, did College Game Day for years and now runs college sports at ESPN. And then there's our guy, Michael Farber, who you know I revere, think he's the best writer of all time. And you told me once, when you're covering the Olympics with Michael Farber, you go, you know, there's the diehard sports fans, that's all they want to eat up. And then Mike's reading an art history book on the bus in Barcelona.
Yeah, Mike Farber is like getting he's like the history of like the Renaissance in Russia or something like that.
Anybody got the comics over here? Like, no, Farber's still just diving into different literature of Vincent van Gogh. Like, okay, fair enough. The best paintings of the collected works of Vincent van Gogh here, Michael Farber.
Now, and I know that you are someone who pays attention to the ratings and your network is obsessed by them, and understandably so. If we were getting right now the first quarter hour ratings for this podcast, they'd be so down. We're not bringing anybody. It's name dropping. It's inside baseball. It's not bringing anyone under the tent. So
fair enough.
We're going to have to like figure out a way to come back. I'm going to start with the Oscars and
sure.
Movies. Not really because I want to, but because it's obviously your energy will stay up at least for this. So I'm playing off your love.
If you recall, by the way, the last time we did this, I said I wanted to do an Inside the Actors Studio with you, and I got to play James Lipton. I don't know if I've ever seen you more disgusting
horrible.
Than we did that last time.
Yeah, terrible. Really boring idea. No one wants to hear about me. So you're obsessed. You love the movies. You've turned this into a passion, both at ESPN as well as. Can you explain to me exactly what you're doing in terms of are you on the red carpet for Facebook or what is your job for the Academy Awards? Because you incredibly enough have like some legitimate job where you're interviewing actors, correct?
Yeah, it's amazing, Rich. I'll tell it from the beginning, and I'll try to be conscious of brevity. But here's how it goes back. It was shortly after I was on your pod, and I'd said to you, if you recall, hey, what if I did my own podcast? And we were joking about, well, everyone and their grandmother seems to have a podcast. But you said, listen, you're passionate about it, and clearly ESPN has shown interest in pop culture at times, so why not? And Dan Stanzik, who is unbelievable, he's been one of my radio producers for 6 years, and he's incredibly loyal and smart and funny, and he said, listen, we'll do it together. Like, I'm in for whatever you want to do, because clearly I was not getting my own radio show anytime soon at ESPN, and still have not. So I said, well, I might as well just do a podcast. I'll get my name out that way, and I love movies, so here we go. And Pete Genesini, who's great, and said, yeah, I mean, I'll give the stamp of approval, even though I think he and Trog Keller met a bit of resistance, because people are saying, well, hang on, where's the sports hook? Well, there is no sports hook. He just loves movies. He's going to talk to actors. He's going to review movies, and that's it. They're like, okay. But thankfully, you know, we've cultivated a modest but loyal following. And Cinephile, I was doing it, I started, like I said, shortly after we did our pod. So that was, let's say, May of 2016. And then Ben Lyons, and you know his dad well, Jeffrey Lyons, the great film critic in New York. Ben is a much better version of me. He loves sports. He loves movies. He's a diehard New York Knicks fan, but he can also talk about Brie Larson's captivating performance in Room. So he was listening to Cinephile, and he and I talked maybe once or twice with Rosillo on the radio. And I knew of him, obviously. And thankfully, he'd heard of me. And he had DM'd me and said, listen, how about I come on Cinephile sometime? We'll do our top 10 films of the year. And just so you know, I'm pushing for you to come to the Oscars with me. I do this thing for Oscar.com. And we're on the red carpet and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, that's never going to happen. Like, how many people have you met in life who say, I'm going to make this happen? But somehow Ben made it happen.
Wow.
Probably incredible. Like, he comes on my podcast. He was great. And then I get a call from my agent. He goes, yeah, you're going to the Oscars. So here's what I'm doing this year, which I did last year as well, which is I'm working for the Academy. Sorry, I have trouble saying it with a straight face, but I'm working for the Academy. It's Oscar.com, singular, OSCAR.com. So you and your wife and all your friends are all going to watch the Oscars with Jimmy Kimmel, as you should. But on your second screen, Ed Placy style, megacast, you pop up your laptop, your iPhone, whatever it is, and put Oscar.com. And you'll see me and Ben Lyons and Sophia Carson, who's wonderful. She's from The Descendants. And this is what it is. It's honestly the best template you can think of is that college football megacast. along with watching the game, you're watching us. So we're literally narrating, Rich, the entire Oscars, and somebody's in our ear telling us what's happening. So they're going to say, best director is Guillermo del Toro. And then me, Ben, and Sophia will start waxing poetic about The Shape of Water and del Toro's directorial oeuvre and just how great Pan's Labyrinth is and Pacific Rim, and another Mexican director wins best director, et cetera. So we're just chatterboxes. And the reason Ben was able to convince his people, because this is like the 12th Oscars he's covered. He worked at E! News for over 10 years. He is so entrenched in this business. He said to them, listen, A, Adnan's a broadcaster, so he can fill the time. That guy can talk. You know, he knows how to just talk for 10, 15 minutes. And he's so passionate and such a lover of movies, he's into this stuff. If you tell him to watch everything, trust me, he'll watch live-action shorts, documentary shorts, animation shorts. Like, he's that guy. So it was an unbelievable experience a year ago. Obviously, I did not own a tuxedo, which does not surprise you. I had to go find a makeshift tuxedo. Here's the biggest thing for anybody who wonders what's the experience like. It is just blinding, the light. Well, I remember that first image when I walked on the red carpet, and I'll be doing so again this Sunday. It's just, it's so bright because there's so many cameras, right? The world is watching. You've got camera crews from everywhere. And the rehearsal the day before was so funny because Ben and I are there, and I go, man, this red carpet is dirty. Like, I just looked down, and it was just like, it's messy. It's just a regular carpet, the Kodak Theater, et cetera. And the next day, it's so pristine. People are vacuuming 24/7. Everything is so shiny. And my cousin Nyla said to me, she goes, well, the movie stars, you know, who looks good? Who doesn't look good? I'm like, are you kidding? Everybody's a 10. Everybody looks spectacular. I'm saying hi to Viggo Mortensen. I'm saying hello to Casey Affleck. Judd Apatow is asking me what I thought of his 30 for 30 about Doc and Daryl. I'm thanking Mahershala Ali, who was the first Muslim ever to win an Academy Award and had been gracious enough to come on my podcast. And he knows my cousin Salim. And so we got to hug it out. And Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, who was following me on Twitter. And so I DM'd him and I said, can you come on my podcast? And he said, sure. This was last November, you know, November 2016. And when I saw Barry on the red carpet, I'll never forget it. We got a picture together. And I said, listen, La La Land's a heavy favorite, but you never know, Barry. You know, you could surprise the world there. And he laughed and he goes, yeah, I think we got a puncher's chance. And I could never imagine, Rich, 4 hours later, the most infamous Oscars mishap of all time. And the guy who I just hugged it out with earlier on the red carpet is now an Academy Award winner, and his movie won Best Picture. Like, it was just, it was incredulous that I get to be a part of it. And here's where it got really nutty. Deadspin, shout out to Timothy Burke, he found the clip of me and Ben and Sophie and Troy Gentile from the Goldbergs. And the clip was of us and reacting to the Oscars. Because, of course, if you were watching it real time, again, I'm not watching it real time, okay? Someone's telling me in my ear. So all they told us is La La Land won. And then our stage director, Denny, who looks a little like Brian Dennehy, started frantically pointing to this camera. So the where we are situated is we're backstage, literally, after they win an Oscar, they walk in a long hallway, and then it's us. It's called the press room. I think it's actually the photographer's room. That's where they stand, they pose, they take their famous Oscar picture, and then the next room is where all the press is. So hardworking scribes like yourself asking penetrating, hard-hitting questions to Emma Stone about winning for La La Land. And then they can go home, or they go to the governor's ball, excuse me, and go eat. So that room where we were, that's where it all unfolded. So all they told us in our ear was, La La Land wins. I'm like, okay. And then me and Ben and Sophia start talking about the great musicals of cinematic history and what a great job by Damien Chazelle, who directed Whiplash. Denny starts pointing frantically, and if you watch the clip on Deadspin.com, and now everyone's seen it, it seems at this point, you'll see my head jerk over. And all I saw was the image that all of you saw in real time, which is when the producer's holding up the card that says Moonlight. And I said, oh, my God, there's been a mistake. And they're like, what? I go, Moonlight won Best Picture. And so Tim put that clip on Deadspin, and I think people had two reactions, Rich. One, why the hell is Adnan Verk at the Oscars? And two, that's a pretty good call of Moonlight winning Best Picture. Like, he's calling it like a play-by-play guy. He's like, oh, my God. Like, it was like a Miracle on Ice type moment, except in the movie. So it was really crazy because afterwards, and you know what this is like, for any broadcaster, you hear you're on Deadspin, you go, oh my God, my career is over. What did I say? What did I do? And then, of course, it was that clip. So Mike Greenberg now is going, why the hell is that in there? Yeah, let's get him on Mike and Mike. And I'm doing every ESPN radio affiliate, and Steve Levy's having me on Sports Center talking about this moment. So it was so funny. When they asked me back again this year, they said, well, we hope there's not this big controversy again, although last year was awfully memorable, and I suppose on a personal level, very memorable as well.
Wait, ESPN doing publicity on something, Adnan? I'm surprised.
that could never happen, right?
So let me ask you this. How does it work in terms of, because this is kind of interesting to me, do you have to approach your bosses and say, this is something I'd like to do? They obviously give you permission, but do you have to take vacation to do this? Like, do you do this on your own time? How does it work in terms of, because while it's good publicity for Adnan Virk and then I guess in theory for ESPN, it's obviously not going on ESPN's platforms.
100%, and that's an excellent question. For all those who wonder, because I saw somebody tweeted to us, you know, how does ESPN let them do this? But you nailed it. They are not letting me do it, so to speak. They're not paying me for this. This is my job, is to do college football and college basketball and baseball and radio. And then this is a side venture. Now, thankfully, ABC, of course, you know, it runs the Oscars. So it's all affiliated part of one major corporation. But I'll give you a specific example. A month ago, on a Thursday or Friday, the people from Oscar.com said, hey, we'd love to have you shoot some vignettes leading up to the Oscars. This was after they had asked me back, which, by the way, it's all year to year. Like, I would love to sign a 30-year deal here with Oscar.com, but they called me. Actually, I was at the national championship in Atlanta when I got the email from Megan saying, hey, we'd like to have you back again. I'm like, awesome. And to your point about vacation days, I had booked the days off already. I booked time off a couple months in advance. So I had booked off Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, this coming weekend, in anticipation of going. But no, if I had not done that, and I was working college basketball, I mean, that's my job. So, like, I've got to get in front of it, so to speak. And like you said, either use vacation days or go from there. So in that instance, I'd already booked it off, so that's fine. I'm clear. I've worked out my days out. Now, recently, a couple weeks ago, they said, we'd like to have you fly out and do a bunch of vignettes with Chef Wolfgang Puck, who makes all the meals for the Governor's Ball, Rebecca Keegan from Vanity Fair, who is a correspondent. Basically do these features. There's a new one actually unloading today. So there's, you know, every day this week, they're doing these 10, 15-minute vignettes. Can we fly out here? And my first response was, Rich, well, yeah, I'd love to do it, but I mean, I got college hoops next week. I'm in studio with Dallin Cuff and Tom Crean, and like, there's just, you know, that's life. You think I'm just sitting around waiting for, I'm not like an actor. I got stuff to do. But thankfully, I talked to my agent. They call the talent office, which is Rob Savinelli. He hits up Lee Fitting and Bill Graff, because listen, it's Oscar.com, which is kind of affiliated with us. It's ABC. They want Adnan to shoot a couple things in L.A. Can you free him up a couple of days? But technically, and thankfully, they were so generous to be like, yeah, no problem. We'll get, I think Zubin Mehenti filled in, or Chris Scott or whomever. Like, yeah, we can do it. It's a couple of days. It's late January. No problem. But if it was, you know, college football Friday and Saturday, no way. That's a quick no. Like, he's got a job to do. Sorry, he's unavailable. So I'm at the mercy of the behest of my bosses, and thankfully they've been nice enough and generous enough to let me do it. But that's an excellent question that you ask, because a lot of people ask me, hey, that's amazing, you're getting paid to do this. I'm like, well, I am getting paid, but it's by the Academy. It has nothing to do with ESPN.
And then I got two more on this topic, then we'll move on to other stuff. Is there any part of you that, I don't know what the word is, but feels odd about celebrating, covering, revering the Oscars in an era of Me Too?
It's an excellent question, again, because I've found that I personally am starting to kind of look at my own hero worship of these people, because, you know, I adore Scorsese and Pacino and De Niro, and frankly, none of those guys have any stories that come out about them. But someone asked me, you know, okay, all of a sudden now you're looking at Dustin Hoffman differently, or you're looking, I mean, listen, Weinstein's a criminal. That's the extreme example. But I'm looking at a guy like James Franco, who I've always been a big fan of. I thought The Disaster Artist was hilarious. I was really hoping he'd get an Oscar nomination. And then I see him on Colbert, and Colbert is brilliant, and thankfully asks him about that story in the New York Times. And I thought Franco did a decent job of answering without obviously being too candid. And then, boom, he doesn't get nominated for the Oscar, even though he probably was going to in the Me Too movement. Now who knows what's going to happen with James Franco? And you start to say, well, how do you revere this guy? How do you like him if he's engaging in clearly despicable behavior? So the answer becomes this. You start to go on a case-by-case basis. You start to say, rather than use a broad brush and paint all of Hollywood as a bunch of you know, sexual harassers, you say, listen, there's always been bad guys and good guys, but you should check yourself and not put these guys on a pedestal. And Dustin Hoffman has always been an incorrigible person, and good for John Oliver for taking him to task for his behavior when he was doing Tootsie and Death of a Salesman on Broadway, et cetera. And maybe Adnan Virk shouldn't think Dustin Hoffman is the cat's meow just because he's a brilliant actor, but you should look at the person themselves or try to separate the person from their art. And that's where it gets tricky. Tarantino is one of my favorite directors. So then I read the story about him and Uma Thurman, I say, that's awful. Like, this guy sounds like a monster. And then I say, were you really that surprised? Like, he's a director. He's a film director. Most of these guys are megalomaniacs. They, of course, feel that they are drunk with power and there's nothing more important than their film and they'll stop at nothing to get it made. So, of course, he's telling Uma Thurman to drive a car that's probably not 100% safe because he wants the shot a certain way and her hair has to be blowing a certain way. And why would I ever think Quentin Tarantino was kind and conscientious? So honestly, you start to have to look at it yourself. The big one, I think, is Woody Allen, because everyone now is saying, well, the hell with Woody Allen. And I say, all right, we all knew that story for years. So now we get to pat ourselves in the back because he made a bad movie with Kate Winslet. But Midnight in Paris, he won a screenplay Oscar for in 2011, his first one since Hannah and Her Sisters. And we all knew the story then. But now all of a sudden it's okay to retroactively say, oh, I never really liked Woody Allen, even though 5 years ago the guy just won an Oscar. So I'm with you. It's a sensitive time. It's a delicate time. And it's interesting. Casey Affleck was the first guy I thought of. Of course, he won the Academy Award last year for Manchester by the Sea. He was amazing. But in the height of Me Too right now, I said there's no way he's going to be here this year, even though traditionally the past winner goes and gives the award. I said, can you imagine that moment? Casey Affleck presenting Best Actress this year to Frances McDormand. Frances McDormand's going to punch him in the face. Like, yeah. You know, Casey Affleck settled the sexual harassment suit, you know, years ago. So I'm with you, man. It's definitely an interesting time and one that's constantly evolving.
Yeah, I can't. I could never give Tarantino any more of my money. I just have to be blunt. After sort of what I've read. All right, finally, Adnan, do this quick because I know you could do this in 10 hours. The Best Picture nominees.
Have we lost Pellegrino? By the way, is he sleeping right now?
Yeah. Lou Pellegrino, producers. He's already out like a light. So I look at these Best Picture nominees, Adnan, and off, yeah, and without having seen all of them, and without, I used to be really into the Oscars. It's been reduced a little bit for me, but I have to think that the Post might be the leader, yeah, in the Vegas odds-on favorite. Or tell me if I'm incorrect.
You're incorrect, Rich, but, okay, but you're right to have that assumption, because before it came out, you thought, all right, Hanks, Merrill and Spielberg. I mean, you got the Holy Trinity here, and it's about journalism. And this is obviously a very hot topic, what the current administration has said about journalism. And this is a period piece set in the 70s, yet feels awfully contemporary, which is a movie that often does really well with the Academy. And yet it has no chance of winning.
You're
and
right.
After I saw it, I said, okay, it's good. It's just not great. All three of those people I mentioned have made significantly superior works. Jason Robards plays a better Ben Bradley in All the President's Men than Hanks does. Not that you should compare actors and roles, but unfortunately, that's just the way it happens sometimes. And I thought Hanks was good, but it felt a little miscast. Not quite Bonfire of the Vanities miscast, but it wasn't one of his best roles.
By the way, I don't mean to interrupt here, but like literally now, as I've done like a second of research on some sites, the Post is like the eighth most likely to win. So I'm not even close. It's like The Shape of Water, Get Out, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. So who's winning this, Adnan? Give it to me right now.
Sure. Neck and neck. It's right now Three Billboards or Shape of Water. Shape of Water won the Producers Guild Award and Directors Guild of Award, and Del Toro is a lock to win for director, even though I would have thought Christopher Nolan was the favorite when Dunkirk first came out in July. Nolan's first nomination, even though he's been snubbed so many times, he should have been nominated for The Dark Knight and Insomnia and so many other films. But Del Toro's going to win. And then the reason why Three Billboards has the best chance is they won the Screen Actors Guild Award. Of course, the largest branch of the Academy is the actors. The fact they won the Screen Actors Guild Award, and it just won the BAFTA. And you know, there's nothing British about a movie set in Missouri, yet somehow even the Brits loved it. So it's neck and neck, Rich. I've got Three Billboards winning, but it's either going to be that or Shape of Water. It's not going to be any of those other films you mentioned. If you want a really wild Moonlight-type upset, Get Out or Lady Bird, but I don't see it happening.
You are so in the tank for Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell. It's embarrassing. But still, they are both excellent actors. All right, Adnan.
Have you seen the film, by the way?
I have not seen the film.
You're not big on the Oscars.
Yeah, I have no. My research on this is, I'm just mocking you because I have nothing to bring to the table, given I have not seen the
film. Having said that, but you were a big movie guy. One of the first tweets that I knew I liked you was you tweeted about L'Amour, which is, listen, that is not a mainstream film. That's a French film starring Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuelle Riva got nominated for Best Actress that year. So you like highbrow cinema.
When I didn't have kids and was able to go to the movies. Yes, but now it's
twins.
Now it's all about Boss Baby starring Alec Baldwin.
Oh, I was about to say animated films. You've seen Boss Baby and Ferdinand.
I've not seen Ferdinand. Boss Baby's horrible. Okay. I like Alec Baldwin as an actor, but it was really unwatchable. I'll be very blunt.
Travesty that was nominated to have Lego Batman. Movie, yeah.
Although I think, I got to give credit to Moana. I thought that actually was really well done. And obviously there's a reason why, why am I blanking on the film with the two princesses, girl, when she's young has powers to create ice. Why am I blanking? Frozen.
Oh, well,
yeah. Frozen. Exactly. Thanks. Frozen's total genius.
Yeah. Listen, you get a good soundtrack with Frozen, right? Let It Go. How tired of that song are you?
Yeah, but you know what? You say that, but if Kristen Chenoweth was at the ESPN radio with you and Wingo, you'd be going to the ESPN cafeteria and getting Josh Krulowitz to get her a latte or something.
right. Listen, Bill Hoffheimer has already tweeted about my love of Kristen Chenoweth, I'm sure. As soon as he hears this, Hoffheimer will be all over.
The great thing about ESPN PR and Bill Hoffheimer in particular is you see, I mean, obviously, Adnan, you're a talented broadcaster. I like you. But let's just say you had a bad show, all right? You didn't bring it to the table. Bill Hoffheimer would say, just great work here by Adnan Ver. Great, consistent work by Adnan Ver. Like, John Starks is 3 of 19. Just incredibly consistent, great work by John Starks.
Right, game 7 of the 94 finals, where Starks went 2 of 18. 0 of
ESPN PR would be like, incredible work by John Starks in that game.
In fairness, though, what would you want them to write, Rich? Would you want them to say it was a terrible performance? You're a PR company,
I guess that's
right?
True. All right, good, fair point. Fair point. All right, Adnan, we're going to make a ridiculous transition here. Oh, by the way, should I ask how surprised you were by Matt Vasgersian and A-Rod coming in? Because, you know, you're a baseball guy. I know you got to be diplomatic here, but I totally never saw it coming. I would have thought that John Shambi and or Carl Ravitch would have gotten that job. I thought both were deserved of all the years. And then Alex Rodriguez comes in with, let's be honest, a little plus one action. And there you go. You got Matty V and Alex Rodriguez and Jess Mendoza.
Yeah, you're asking my reaction.
How far can you go, Adnan, without getting fired answering this question?
I was about to say, this is where everybody starts to download with an 860 area code. I was stunned. I exactly what you just said. I thought it would either be Boog or Ravi, both of whom I'm friendly with, and I'm a huge fan of both of them. John Shambi loves baseball like no one's business. He's up there with Kirchen in terms of his love of baseball. He's called it for so many years at a high level. And Carl Ravitch has been the face of baseball for ESPN for 2+ decades. There's no better host than Ravi. He's so quick on his feet with Baseball Tonight, and he's made a nice transition to play-by-play. He's done College World Series and Little League World Series for years, had done more Major League games. So, yeah, I thought either of those guys. Dave Fleming also does a brilliant job. Dave does great work with the San Francisco Giants, and Flem does her Monday Night Baseball with Eddie Perez. So I thought Flem was in the mix. Maybe my buddy Adam Amin out of nowhere. Like, I would have thought, you know, because Amin does a great job on the radio. I definitely thought with Dan Shulman leaving, you know, one of those very worthy candidates would get a job. But it's one of those you go, all right, you know what? It doesn't always make sense necessarily. Like, this is not a union. It is not necessarily next man up. So even though you would think that we just have somebody in-house, sometimes you say, all right, well, we want A-Rod and Matt Vasgersian is part of the deal, so away you go. Now, I love Vasgersian. I think he does a terrific job in play-by-play, and he's obviously a talent. But I agree with you. That was definitely a surprise to me. Look, if Joe Buck, who is our Dan Shulman, if Joe Buck left, you would assume that Vasgersian or Kevin Burkhardt or one of those guys would get the gig. It would be awfully odd if John Shambi all of a sudden became the voice of baseball at Fox. So I think if you use that analogy, you can kind of guess where our reactions were.
And then quick answer, more power, Alex Rodriguez or Vladimir Putin? Who has more power, would you say, in the dynamic?
Here's the better question. I just saw Phil Orlins, one of our radio bosses, and I said, over under, how many times has A-Rod come to Bristol? Like, how many Baseball Tonights am I actually going to have him in studio in Bristol? And I'm sitting the over under at a half. And he said, well, I'll take the over because he's actually coming this Thursday. Okay, that's fine. That's one thing. How many more times? Like, is A-Rod going to come trade deadline? Me, Buster, only Kirchen? Like, probably not.
No.
And will he bring J-Lo? Will she hang out in the green room?
She might. I will say this, though. I actually like when networks allow talent to work for both places. I think that's actually very viewer-friendly and cool. It's one of those things where I know that Vital has always wanted to do a basketball game with Barkley, and Turner's a little bit more of the pain in the ass than your employers. And, like, I like that. I just think, like, stuff like that is, generally speaking, viewer-friendly. And, you know, for Alex Rodriguez, if there's a value for both ESPN and Fox, I kind of like the idea when you could share them. There really is no one in television, sports television, maybe with the exception of like a Barkley and maybe with the exception of like, you know, an Al Michaels, where like it's really going to game change the audience if you, if they were exclusive to that network. So I think it's an interesting, I think it's actually an interesting move from both Fox and ESPN. But, you know, as you head down, the not necessarily the problems, but what moves like this mean, it does take away airtime for other analysts. And that's when it gets tricky. And that's when your management has to figure all this out.
Yeah, I did definitely hear that murmurings of, you know, what is the trickle-down effect? And does this set a bad precedent? But I like your point about sharing broadcasts, because I was so myopic. One of the biggest myths when I first got this business, and amazingly, it's been 15 years now I've been on air and 20 years in the business, was I thought just as competitive as the industry were, that's how the reporters and anchors were. Meaning, growing up in Toronto, I thought the rivalry between TSN and Sportsnet wasn't just among executives, it was actually among anchors. And then it was so ridiculous. The first time I went to a Leafs practice or a Raptors practice, and David Amber's chatting up Elliot Friedman, and everybody gets along. Like, are you kidding? Like, we're all the same job here, dude. What do you think we care what Mike Flash for holding? Like, at the end of the day, we're all expendable cattle. So I'm with you. There's never a rivalry among analysts. The other day, you mentioned Charles Barkley. He was texting Jay Williams, telling me, hey, give me something on Kentucky. I got to get ready for the tournament. So everybody is in cahoots.
Yeah, I mean, they do compete against each other, but Fox and ESPN also have a lot of partnerships, and so, you know, it's at times it's very competitive. At times it's obviously collegial. It's always fun though when the PR departments go behind the scenes and will leak you like ratings information, bad ratings information for the other guys. That's fantastic in my position.
You didn't hear it from me, but here it is.
Yeah. All right. So now we really will. Is there any other colleague you would like to mention before any new colleague other than A-Rod? Who's going to get the? Do you agree with me that if I had to put the odds on favorite Monday Night Football analyst job, it's Matt Hasselbeck or Randy Moss odds on favorite, as opposed to bringing in some famous guy from the outside?
Well, I think, listen, the touchdown, the Hail Mary would be Peyton Manning.
Of course.
If he was available and interested. But I don't know where that standing is and whether or not he would have the inclination to do it. Because as you know, this job is harder than people think. I mean, Romo was unbelievable. And I say this as a passionate Philadelphia Eagles fan. I'm so happy we won the Super Bowl. I couldn't stand Tony Romo all those years as a face of the Cowboys. So when I first heard the cacophony of noise from you and others saying how great he was, I said, okay, let me just take a look at this pretty boy Romo. And then he was great. I said, oh my God, this guy's funny. He's self-aware. He made Nance better because the Nance seemed more invigorated, right? It seemed more refreshed. It had a better sense of humor. And I'm like, all right. So there's only so many Romos that you can hit on, and it works out that well. But I think Peyton would be a guy, you just imagine him with Monday Night Football. The guy I'm pushing for is Jesse Palmer. Jesse does an unbelievable job with me on college football. He looks like $1 million. He single-handedly helped Canadian tourism because every woman thinks that we're all as good-looking as Jesse. So they go up there and they're all disappointed. But Jesse is so well-studied. He's so knowledgeable. He's been called great games. He's called games. Look at this. He's called games with Fowler, with Reese Davis, with Brent Musburger. He's called Rose Bowls. He's done studio with me and Joy Galloway. I understand Jesse didn't play very long in the NFL, but he did play in the NFL. So I think the guy I was pushing for is Jesse. I don't know if he's going to get it, but just if you want me to stump for a colleague, that's the guy I'm pushing for.
Yeah, it's a big stump. Isn't he doing Daily Mail TV now as well?
That's correct. I know you DVR that every day. That's syndicated. Yeah. It's huge in New York. It's on buses. It's
but aren't you really, I mean, he's another Canadian. Aren't you just flogging for yet another Canadian with Jesse Palmer as opposed to somebody else?
I didn't even realize he was born in Nepean, Ontario, grew up a huge Montreal Canadiens fan, loves the Ottawa Rough Riders. I had no idea of that. Wow, thanks for, I didn't even realize.
You think Jay and Dan are happy about being back at TSN?
They made a joke. It was great because we simulcast trade.
I saw the video. It was pretty funny. They took a big shot at Fox. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, it was great. So for those who didn't see it, James Duffy, who's brilliant, said, hey, Jay and Dan, you guys want to take a shot at Fox? You're on ESPN2 right now because you're simulcasting. And immediately, Jay and Dan like, what? Fox? What? Never heard of that. Don't know what you're talking about. So good for them for having fun with it.
But, all right, last one with this. With Dan Shulman back, Jay and Dan back, who now is the most obviously it's Renee Young, so we'll eliminate her from WWE. Who is the most well-known person born in Canada who is now working in American sports broadcasting? Is it Adnan Verk?
I think it's Jesse. Because Jesse's
Jesse Palmer, not Julie Stewart Binks, Adnan Verk. We love
JSB crushing it, Barstool Radio. But listen, Jesse is the Bachelor appeal. Like if you said to your wife Jesse Palmer, she'd be like, oh, that guy who was on The Bachelor, which was 2006. But like his cross promotion is amazing.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Is there anyone else? He might be the answer. Is there anyone else who's working in the States, born in Canada?
Can we give a shout out to our boy Arda, who was part of the Muslims in Sports Media conversation?
Arda O'Cal, but he's. I mean, no offense to Arda, he's not as famous as Jesse Palmer. He's a quality broadcaster for sure. It's not Julie. If it's not you, I think you might be number two though. What is it like to be the Pippin in this equation?
Binks is going to be furious once you said that. I mean, she was one of the early acolytes of the SI Media podcast.
Julie, listen, Julie's great. She's super talented, but you are more well-known than Julie Binks. That's just, I think even Julie would admit that.
Yeah,
if both of you walk down the streets of Omaha, Nebraska, 100 people, 99 are not going to recognize either of you, but I feel like the one who does recognizes you and not Julie.
I was going to say the one maybe because I covered the College World Series in Omaha one year with that.
I think it's going to be
the Red Sox.
Yeah, college football. It's going to be the college football recognition.
Right. And I think that might be the one.
Right. And then the last.
I can't believe the fact. By the way, with you, I just want to mention, now that we're mentioning Canada and America, with you being traded to Canada, the fact that you're imminently moving to Toronto, and I was traded to America, we need to find a sports trade equivalent. It could be Kordic for Cordinal, for all the hockey fans listening, one of the most infamous trades in recent memory. Baseball fans, Broglio for Brock, of course, back in the 60s. We need to find a big Burke for Deitch. What kind of sports
trade?
Well,
I'm going to be like a third-line center, and you're more of, I feel like, a... You're kind of a I'm trying to think of who's a good second line you're like a Rick Nash type. So you know.
Oh wow.
You'd have to throw more draft picks for me if you're going to make that deal.
It's Richard Deitch, the fan, plus future consideration.
I'm a Leo Komarov type is what I like. I'm just going to try to I'm going to try to fill in when I can on the fourth line. Match me up against the best of TSN, so I could hold them down, and then McCowan and Stephen Brunt will basically score the goals. They're the Marner and Matthews of the outfit. That's how I look at it.
This is the thing. You're a big time Buffalo Sabres fan, so I'm curious as to when
I would not say that. I am aware of the team because I used to live in Buffalo, but I definitely would not call myself a big time fan.
No, but you tweet your support of the Sabres and always mention the fact you work there, live there. So are you going to flip to Toronto or just say, well, I'm close enough to Buffalo, I can maintain my Sabres allegiance?
I don't really have it. I'm not sure I'm fandom of either. I really sort of, you lose your fandom when you're in this business for the most part. Not everything, but for
That's
the most
true.
Part. So I think I've said this 2 years ago, the Leafs are a super fun team to watch and follow. So they're I love Buffalo, but it's not even close. The Leafs are far more enjoyable to watch. That's a no-brainer. I think the Leafs are going to win the Cup in the next 2 years. Next 3 years. Not this year, but I think they're really set after that for those 2 years. If they can add a top-line defenseman, I think they got a shot.
You just gave delirium to everybody listening on Yonge Street right now. They've been planning that parade since 1967. They've been planning it since I was born. It's the hysteria of that team, if they ever do win, it's going to be unbelievable.
How great would it be if I'm up there at that scene and you are in Connecticut celebrating University of Hartford victory?
No, it'll be early June. I'll be doing a talk back with Alex Rodriguez. He's calling the Cubs. He's at Wrigley. I'm in Bristol, Connecticut. You're live at the parade. My buddy Cabby, the whole gang is out there. Dusty, Bob McCallum. That would be great.
By the way, let's not kid ourselves. Alex Rodriguez will be doing the talk back because he will have replaced you as well as every other person at ESPN.
He tees up himself.
Your gig at that point will be you'll be driving Ben Lyons around Los Angeles.
Yes.
Hoping for a
Ben
gig.
Ben Lyons and me have great chemistry. I don't know if anyone's ever going to care about that, but we would definitely have to make a good show together somewhere.
Hey, it's that time again, that familiar crossroads of choosing between basketball and hockey. Wait a second, you can't choose. They're both on. Why are they both on? Relax. We have a solution. Buffalo Wild Wings. Rather than fill your living room with televisions, come into B-dubs. We've got hockey and basketball on, each playing on dozens of screens, so that you don't have to choose. And to complete the trifecta, we can ensure you have access to all the sports foods you crave. From our selection of America's favorite wings and any of our 21 signature sauces and seasonings, to shareable favorites like cheddar cheese curds and fried pickles, you'll have everything you've ever wanted. But wait, we also have a variety of beers to quench your thirst, all the basketball, all the hockey post-trade deadline, all the food and all the beer you want. It's Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings Beer Sports. Please drink responsibly. And now back to my conversation with Adnan Virk. All right, this is going to be a worse segue, Adnan, but you know I always do that to you. So let's talk about True Islam. It's unbelievable. The segue of all time.
Say with a straight face. That's
right.
Great.
All right, one of the things you and this is honestly important. You were part of a panel that I did with I think it was seven Muslims who are in sports broadcasting. And, this was at the height of a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric. I mean, obviously it still exists today going on in Washington and elsewhere. And it was a really interesting panel to me because I don't think viewers in the States are particularly aware of the fact that there are a number of Muslims who are in sports broadcasting, prominent ones who are on air, including yourself. So first question to you is how comfortable are you talking about this now? Because you've become more public with the True Islam campaign, and you know that this is tricky terrain to navigate, given that your employer has found itself in some difficult situations when people talk about politics, let alone religion.
Yeah, first off, thanks for doing that roundtable, because the amount of feedback that I got from people was great. So credit to you for actually wanting to discuss an issue, which I'm sure even your employers would say, you know what, I don't know how much interest there is in this. And thanks to Peter King, because I remember he tweeted the article and said, heartfelt work here by Richard Deitch, especially from Adnan ESPN. So thanks to you and to the great Peter King. But you're right. You know, my dad growing up, Rich, said to me two things you never discussed, politics and religion. And now all of a sudden that's all anybody ever wants to talk about. And my dad said, because there's never a winner. No matter what, you can't ever get on the same page. And as I'd mentioned to you in that article, like the rise of anti-Islamic rhetoric was just, it was stunning to me. And I'll never forget that moment watching one of the town halls and Trump answered a question about anti-Muslim rhetoric by creating more of it. He was asked about the San Bernardino shooting, and the woman said to him, like, do you realize that, you know, because of your statements, you know, rather than showing compassion to the Muslim community, you instead stoked the fire? And Trump, you can look up the answer yourself. I mean, I'm not quoting him specifically, but he said basically, well, you know, who knows how many people at that mosque knew what those guys were planning, and it's really incumbent upon the Muslim community to start, you know, telling us who the perpetrators are and to rat them out. And I'm like, this is insane. And I've done more research about it. You mentioned the True Islam campaign on Twitter. They're great. They've been so good as far as just trying to create more information and knowledge. Because here's the scary truth, Rich. Guys like yourself who are educated and open-minded, I worry how much of that exists, because the stats that I look at is say that the vast, well, I don't want to say vast, but a lot of Americans don't know any Muslims, and most Muslims live in major urban centers. So, you know, you're in New York City. That's one thing. You're dealing with Muslims. You meet them all the time, et cetera. If I'm in Franklin, Wisconsin, and I see that Trump town hall, and I'm already leaning towards Trump, and I say, well, yeah, okay, he's right. Fine. I don't know any Muslims. And the stuff I see is brutal. Whenever I see these terrorists commit these horrible crimes, like, well, yeah, I'm not a racist, but we do got to keep these guys out. Yeah, okay, fine. You know what? A temporary Muslim ban, that does make sense to me. And it's terrifying to me how that wave starts to create some momentum. And as I said to you in that article, the day after, like I went to bed and I'm still stunned that he's the president. I said, there's no way. Like, give me anybody but him. He's the guy who's been the most negative and the most hostile towards Muslims. And the next day when I told my son Yusuf, I have three boys, I was taking Yusuf to school, he's nine. And I didn't bring it up. He could see I was ashen-faced and downcast. And when he said to me, well, who won? And I said, Trump. And this is a nine-year-old kid, Rich. He, look at his face. He's like, what? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, now I'm going to have a terrible childhood like Jackie Robinson. And I was torn between laughing and hugging him, because he had just done a book report about Jackie Robinson and how he faced segregation and racism and all that hatred and vitriol. And I said, that just makes me sad. That just makes me despondent that my own child thinks that this is the country that we're living in, that now he's going to face this type of situation. But just as the country itself is so polarized, that's why I failed at living in Connecticut, which is a blue state. You know, we live in West Hartford, which, you know, it feels like because you're surrounded by like-minded people that the issue or the threats or the concerns are not as strong. But then we had a terrible incident after the Paris attacks. We had a shooting at our mosque, and our president of our mosque had to get a few of us together and said, okay, here's what's happened. The FBI is investigating. And it ended up being the next door neighbor where we are in Meriden, Connecticut. Wow. Had a few too many drinks. It's 2 a.m. in the morning. He sees what happened in Paris. He grabs one of his many guns. He's a former Marine. And he just took a few shots. And that image of looking in your place of worship and just seeing bullet holes, I mean, it was staggering to think that, you know, for Friday prayers next week, we're going to have the Meriden police here outside. And I don't frequent other places of worship, so I don't know if there's armed security at churches or synagogues, but at a mosque, I've never seen that before. We had to actually have cops outside. And, you know, when you see something like that, then obviously, you know, the reality really hits home of what's happening in the world right now. So it's obviously can be scary, but all you can do is pray, and all you can do is try to focus and hope for the best and try to educate, which is what True Islam's about. I think, like I said, a lot of that ends up being ignorance. I don't know any Muslims. What I see is negative, so I'm going to believe the negativity, and that's where my mind is at. Whereas if you can actually learn what the religion is, you say, okay, well, obviously they have nothing to do with terrorism. These psychopaths have hijacked their faith, actually have nothing to do with it. And this is why that they've subverted certain quotes in the Quran and go from there. And then I think people can try to go down that path. Now, specific to me, I had said to one of my best friends, Hussein, who's now an actor in L.A., exactly what you said. I said, well, what can I do? Like, what possible good can I do? Like, obviously, I can't mention on ESPN platforms my faith or what I'm about. And he said, listen, just by you being who you are, you're doing something good. And I said, what does that mean? And he goes, well, enough people are going to watch you on college football or college basketball or baseball, and they're not caring about your religion necessarily, but they might hear about this Richard Deitch podcast, and they might Google your name, and one of the first things that pops up is first Muslim sportscaster at ESPN. So that may turn the wheels a bit and say, okay, you know what? I don't think everyone's like this. This guy seems pretty normal. Seems like a good dude. Maybe I shouldn't have a negative opinion of all these guys. And credit to my good friend Ryan Russillo. You know what a big fan I am of him and what you are as well. After the Orlando shooting, he offered me the opportunity to talk about what's happening in the world on ESPN Radio. And that's still a segment people talk to me about. And Ryan said, listen, I saw that terrorist attack. And I got to be honest, even a part of me says, let's do something about this. We got to work on immigration, et cetera. Maybe this is a good idea, temporary bans and such. And Ryan said, but then I thought about you. And I said, I wouldn't know you. I wouldn't know your family. You know, when initially that travel ban was instituted, like Buster only sends me this email and goes, you know, what's to stop Canada being on that list? And I said, I don't know. Like that, if that happened, what would happen? Would you have to leave the country? And this seems implausible. And yet I to me, it was like, well, those are legitimate questions if we end up going down this road. So Ryan allowed me to talk about Islam and being a Muslim, which I never thought was a big deal until all of a sudden, as you said, it's become an issue now. So I think you look for those opportunities. Kathy Leo Grant is a good friend. Her daughter, Allie, is a rising star at ESPN. She's a professor at Lemoyne University. She said, we'd love to have you come to Lemoyne sometime. You can talk about broadcasting. You can talk to the film classes, and you can talk to the religion classes as well. So there's an Islam 101. There's a film 101. There's a journalism 101. And maybe that's a better avenue. Maybe by talking to people, one-on-one, you can try to get your positive message across.
And then how do you go about the calculation of if there's something that someone says or you see something that just really personally offends you as a Muslim, what's the calculation of you mentioning this on your social media feeds versus not?
Another terrific question. So in the past, there was one time I did a Mike and Mike, and I'd been off for a couple of weeks. I actually went home to Toronto. I think it was actually the All-Star game when it was in Toronto. The NBA. And when I came back, I had grown a beard. And part of that is just laziness, right? When you're off as a broadcaster and you have to shave all the time, you go, God, I can't wait to not shave. And Dan Stanzik, who I mentioned, is my brilliant producer, cinephile, said, oh, man. And I said, what? He goes, you're going to get some comments today. And I said, you think? He said, oh, yeah. And I would say it was 7:30. I'm like, this is aggressive so for some early morning racism. But somebody put some inflammatory comments, some of the effect of, oh, no, don't be one of those crazy Muslims. Don't be this infidel sacrificing virgin, something along those lines. And I kind of read it aloud and said, listen, I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but I knew it. Like, this is the country we live in now. People are taking shots. They use social media. They keyboard cowards, et cetera. And in the past, I'm sure what my company would tell me and ESPN PR would say, well, just block it. That's it. But Scott Van Pelt once told me something interesting. He said, because Scotty likes to engage sometimes with his trolls. And he goes, yeah, okay. I'll go back one. Mike Greenberg told me, Jay Billis told him, don't punch down. Never respond to the trolls. You're somebody. You're somebody of consequence. They're trying to get Adnan Burke. You don't let them. You're somebody, so never respond. And Scotty then, when I asked him, I told him that story. He goes, yeah, that's true to a point. But you don't get to dictate what happens. Just because you get to send a tweet, that doesn't allow you to make me upset or make me mad. So I'm allowed to answer back a little bit. And Scott is the first to joke about it. He gets entangled in it way too much. And then it's 4 a.m. and he sent 30 tweets. But he goes, it's okay to go back and forth. So that specific instance, I remember thinking, well, you should block it. But I said, no, that's not fair. Like, you've now impacted my day because of what you said was so malicious. And I know people like Jamel Hill get it tenfold. But that particularly to me was so upsetting. So I think this is a very passive-aggressive, very Canadian approach, but either I retweeted or quote-tweeted. I think I quote-tweeted, thanks for the feedback. And then you get your army of Adnan followers who then are just going to bombard the guy. Now I've got Keith Law doing my dirty work and everybody else who's responding to this, racist, and eventually he apologizes meekly. Oh, I was just kidding around. It was fine. But that was a rare instance. Generally, I would just try to block and ignore it because I find – and Jesse Palmer, again, he said to me, well, you shouldn't block because that's part of the rule of social media. Like, if you signed up for it, you should be able to take it. And I said, yeah, but you shouldn't be able to impact my day. If you say something mean-spirited about me, right. I want to respond. And if I can't respond, the only impulse I have is to block, and then I can't think about it. So that's generally the approach that I'll employ.
Yeah, I used to, when I first started out on Twitter, I was like Jesse Palmer and thought you just literally was like sort of wrong to block. You've joined this public service. I've come 180 on that. I think you should block anybody who you just do not, that you don't want part of your ecosystem. And usually, I think most reasonable people are only making blocks if it really gets to a certain place, not just pure disagreement. Last one for me, Adnan, on this topic is how would you assess the coverage of Muslim athletes in terms of frequency, depth, and tone?
I think it's starting to increase a little bit. I know Marcus Spears did a story, which was really good. I believe, I want to say Rhonda Hollis Jefferson, or it was definitely a prominent Muslim athlete recently that I saw that was excellent. And I think that there's been more stories now kind of, you know, hearkening to the past and saying, okay, listen, remember Muhammad Ali, you know, remember Hakeem Olajuwon, and kind of go from there. And the story of Ibtihaj Muhammad, the fencer, who competed for America and wore a hijab. And now that there's more stories about athletes in other countries wearing a hijab, the Muslim headscarf, and competing in sports. So I think it's increasing, you know, slowly but surely. And I think that's a credit to those news organizations who are saying, okay, again, back to your original point, this is tricky to intersect politics and sports, but it's a major topic. And if we're not covering it, then we're probably not doing our job on a journalistic basis. So I think that more of those news editors and more news reporters in whatever organization, whether nationally or locally, are saying, okay, are there Muslim athletes that we are not focusing on? Can we do this in a way? I mean, particularly the NBA right now. I mean, you've got LeBron James opining about the NCAA or whatever he wants. He's calling them corrupt. So you're going to find people who want to speak and are finally giving a platform with which to speak. But you're right. Just to circle back to your point about ESPN, Barry Blinn, who's a fantastic guy with ESPN, said to me, you know, you do have to be careful because our audience leans right. And he goes, particularly your sports, you cover college football. I mean, this is the Deep South and the Midwest, and baseball is a sport that, again, skews older and white. So you don't want to be this guy who becomes the paragon of the left and starts alienating the audience. But then I don't ever want to be Michael Jordan. I don't want to be the guy who's saying, you know, Republicans buy shoes too. I'm like, well, no, I mean, this is my opinion. And especially if I'm doing it when I'm talking to Richard Deitch on his podcast or I'm talking to students at Lemoyne, I don't understand how I can't do that. If I'm doing it on college football final at 1 a.m, that's a much different story. So I do think the coverage is improving, and I am happy to see it.
Adnan Virk, as I said at the top, is at first he's Canadian, which is outstanding. Second, he now works for Alex Rodriguez, which will be a challenge, I think, for sure. And he is the host of what is that college football show? What is the exact name of it?
Yeah, so it's College Football Final. It's tough to explain, right? Because you say college football raps. What does that mean? Well, I rap around the work. I'm at the halftime shows. Oh, okay. So you just hang around all day? I'm like, well, it's a 15-hour day. I'm like, we've got games at noon, 3:30, 7, 10, 15, 10:30, and then College Football Final with me, Joey, and Jesse.
That is a long day. You do college basketball. Do you have any games yet assigned for MLB?
I just got my schedule from my boss, Phil. I'm calling one in Mexico, May 6th. Yeah, I've got one in San Diego later that month. I'm doing the Celebrity All-Star Game for the fourth year in a row. Jamie Foxx.
I know you liked it, but no offense. It's no offense to you. You know I like you a lot. That's unwatchable. I'm going to the Stanley Cup playoffs that day.
Do you at least appreciate the silliness of it? Like just saying, listen, it's all about fun and frivolity.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But like the NBA All-Star Game, it just becomes nothing more than a promotional vehicle for ESPN. It's like, here's our new show. And oh, by the way, Frankie Muniz just hit a layup. It's a lot to take.
I'll let Cassie know you were not locked into this year's NBA.
I do like Cassie, though. I certainly respect her work. But I was not locked into this year's game.
No, she's awesome. The crazy thing, by the way, the baseball Celebrity Game, it's one of the top 5 rated baseball events on ESPN, which I said, how is that possible? But there's an appetite for it, and I think it's because it airs after the Home Run Derby, which is, of course, one of our crown jewels.
Right. Is that All-Star Game baseball stream? Don't you have former, like, don't you have, like, Ricky Henderson types, too, make it kind of interesting?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was amazing. Ricky Henderson hit a leadoff home run, and I went bananas. And then Dan Lebatard on their show, they were laughing their heads off. Like, I can't really be that excited about Ricky Henderson going deep. Like, well, he did play for the Jays. He was the greatest leadoff hitter of all time. He may have been that excited.
In homage to Berman, did you, like, drop a 1980s nickname wow, he took that one out to Sonny Crockett land or something. I mean, did you drop something like that or no?
I should have. You know, it's funny because I'm such an idiot. I'm always like, well, I've got to call the game. And in my head, I'm like, it's a Celebrity Game, dude. Like, seriously, take whatever suggestions people want. You want to say goofy stuff? Like, on Levitard's show, they have this looks like game. They say I look like a guy who killed James Bond, or James Bond, one of his henchmen, trying to protect James Bond. I said, welcome to Tangier. So in my head, no matter what, I'm using that as a home run call. So actually, Ricky's leadoff home run, I said, welcome to Tangier. And then I actually used it during a regular season game on an Aaron Judge home run. So I'm definitely wearing out that line. But you're right, I could definitely take some chances.
What's the best Roger Moore Bond? Man with a Golden Gun?
Octopussy?
No. Is Live and Let Die More? What's the one? What's the one with Jane Seymour's first movie ever in Yaphet Kotto?
Oh yeah. Oh, is that that may be Live and Let Die.
That's the best Roger Moore film by far. Octopussy. That's when that was like Moore's like cheeky James Bond, right?
Yeah, that was definitely critically.
You can't like that.
I mean, Connery's the best Bond of all time.
Well, of course. That's not even a debate.
Yeah, but Roger Moore, they say, like, genuinely nice guy, which when they report that, like, after that. Roger Moore passed, it's like, oh, really? Like, well, that has to be the headline. Like, are you kidding? It's Hollywood. This guy's actually a good dude. We got to tell people that.
Yeah, all right, here you go. Roger Moore, Yaphet Kotto, Jane Seymour. It's Live and Let Die, 1973. Although, surprisingly, on the IMDb website, only a 6.8. I'm a little disappointed with that. That should be a little lower.
Go Rotten Tomatoes. They've been good to me. I'll check out those guys.
Yeah, I will. But that far and away, by the way, that's the best. That's the best Moore Bond movie. That's Roger before he's cheeky and making all these ridiculous one-liners and puns. He's kind of he's a little bit of a badass on that. By the way, what a podcast that I'm dropping movies that are 45 years old. Really going to getting those millennials coming through this episode.
I'm just going to have to go, hey, that guy Deitch was not invested in this year's Oscars. He thought the post was going to win, but man, he loves Yaphet Kotto.
Yeah, it's the first Yaphet Kotto reference on here. All right, Adnan, the next guest is Dave Revson. Is there anything you want me to pass on to Dave Revson? Did you ever work together?
I've never met Dave, but I hear raves about him. I hear he's a great dude from the light. Very Steve Buhnen-esque is what people tell me. A nice guy, good writer. You know, there's so many of these people, and this is scary to think about. I was class of 2010, and I'm now the last man standing in Bristol, last man or woman, because it was Sarah Walsh, Steve Weissman, Don Bell, and now Max. Brad Oss is going out to L.A. So I can't believe the amount of turnover in 8 years. Deuces Rogers, Mike Gamm, and Anish Shroff. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, by the way,
how much has changed.
You know, you have a reputation, obviously, of being one of the nicest people in Bristol, but the person who really is, I think, considered the nicest person in Bristol, Connecticut, other than, and by the way, it would normally be Holly Rowe. But she's not based in Bristol. It's David Lloyd. Would you agree with that?
David Lloyd is unbelievable. Yeah. You're right. And David Lloyd has a good reputation of being very underrated, like among other. Like David
Andrews would
always tell me, he goes, David Lloyd is terrific. Neil Everett, who I love, said to me, the best anchor that nobody talks about is David Lloyd. They go, he's so understated. He's a terrific writer. He can do it all. You're right. D. Lloyd.
David Lloyd basically considered that. I think
Cowboys fan, though. Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah, but I don't think I've ever heard a singular human being say anything but rave things about David Lloyd.
I agree. I mean, I'm trying to find one. Like, I want to besmirch him now just to be the first.
But
he's
not,
like,
you
good
can't
father,
find
father.
It.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Him. I was going to say, all nice guy team is him, Steve Buhnen, Michael Kim, one of the all-timers.
Yeah, very nice guy. Super guy. All right, listen, Adnan, this has been exciting. Your return to this podcast, and we can only hope for 60,000 downloads. Adnan Verk.
I was going to say,
we're not going to get like 180. I'm hoping. I got to be realistic on this. This is not part of my take.
But please tell me what Jimmy Traina thinks and Orand, because when you and Orand and Traina did your favorite hosts, Orand picked me. But you can look this up. Orand picked me early, and his rationale made no sense. He said, "I'm stealing one of Richard's favorites, Adnan Verk, and he knows how to connect with audiences." Evidenced by the numbers he put up in the SI Media podcast. So you and I have established that those numbers were goosed.
Right.
So essentially, Orin is saying he doesn't actually think I do a good job. He knows you like me, and he's using numbers which were false.
That was one of those picks where you're trying to get, like, the guy not to go to your division or to your league. Like, didn't the Vegas Knights just pay a lot of money for, was it Derek Brassard? That was what Orin did, though. He basically made a Derek Brassard move. He's not even, I don't know who he picked, but he's not using you. He's going to use Van Pelt and Kostas for the most part.
People are like, oh my God, I can't believe Orand likes him. Like, no, he likes Van Pelt, okay? He's all but the Terps. He's just trying to screw over.
Right. I think you're getting, you'll be on ESPN Snap. That's what I've been told, on Orand's network or the new new OTT service. All right, Adnan Verk, I've given his resume now five times and I can't give it again. Adnan, thank you very much for your second appearance. Best of luck with the Oscars broadcast that people can check that out and continued success, sir.
Thank you so much, Rich. I appreciate it. Make sure you tweet it out. Check it out, Oscar.com. And by the way, last question for you.
Yes.
How much money is Nick Jr. giving you? With all those tweets you send out, trolling Skip, Paw Patrol, Chase, Rubble, like, you've mentioned all their shows now. Like, it's unbelievable.
I know. I've announced that I'm trying not to do that anymore. I've gotten $0 from Nick Jr., unfortunately. This is not ESPN when you and Herb Tree could do a Pizza Hut commercial and get a lot of money. It's not working for me.
I'm all about Chick-fil-A, but thanks, Rich.
All right. Adnan Verk, everyone. Thank you, Adnan.
Thanks, man.
All right, let's take a break. And before we move on, let me tell you about Mattress Firm. Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm. Except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this. They are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed. From adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor, they have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast now to see what deals are happening. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. All right, and as promised, we bring in Dave Revson, the lead host of the Big Ten Network, who is in New York for the Big Ten basketball tournament. Dave, it's been a while, but since we've talked about doing this, and I'm glad we finally got it done, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
It is great to be on with you, Richard, and honored to be talking to Toronto's newest talk radio host. Congratulations to you. What a neat deal.
Yeah, thank you. Toronto's newest F-list celebrity.
As a longtime F-list celebrity, I know what you're about to go through, and I'm happy for you and enthused.
All right, so Dave, here's what I want. Before I get to some Big Ten stuff, I do want to ask you, you were very transparent and honest with the audience, your audience, not too long ago, about getting Bell's palsy, which is a temporary nerve condition that paralyzes one side of the face. How is that now? And I mean, this is an obvious answer, but I mean, how concerning and troubling was that, given one, it's your health, and two, you're a broadcaster, so you're part of a visual medium?
It was very concerning. First of all, to answer your question, I'm doing much better. It actually kind of, it's been a really weird 6 weeks. I mean, I would preface it by saying kind of all along this knowledge that it is, as you said, almost always temporary. I mean, there are rare exceptions where there are parts of it that linger, but you know, you kind of think of what other people in this business have gone through, and you know, I work with Stuart Scott, and you think of all the other people who, you know, have struggled or continue to struggle with serious health issues. You know, I just kind of wanted to let people know where I was, and I was overwhelmed by the outpouring of support, almost embarrassed, honestly, at the attention, because it was just a temporary thing. But to answer your question, it was frightening, and it's much better now. There's still a little bit of issue with one of my eyes that doesn't quite blink in sync with the left eye, doesn't seem to quite blink in sync with the right eye, but it can often take, you know, up to a year and certainly months, and it's only been about 6 weeks for me. I was much better about 3 or 4 weeks in and actually returned to work for a couple of days and then had a crazy deal on Super Bowl Sunday where I had vertigo, like just the room started spinning out of control, and vomiting. Next day at the emergency room, had an emergency MRI. I mean, fortunately, everything was all right. And what they think happened was that the same virus that attacked the nerve that inflamed that nerve for the Bell's palsy, they think attacked the adjoining virus, which is, or the adjoining nerve, which is the vestibular nerve, which goes into your ear and affects your balance. So that's thrown me off too, and I'm kind of still off kilter. And so this has been going on for 6 or 7 weeks, but again, I just kind of am thankful that both of these things are temporary conditions and that they'll go away. And the outpouring of support was amazing. I mean, I'm not normally someone who, I'm not great on Twitter. I should be better. I don't always interact with fans as well as I should. And you just don't really know, is what we're doing resonating? And the fact that people reached out in the way that they did, I mean, just absolutely blew me away. And it was crazy. And it really did kind of reinforce that connection. And then hearing from a ton of people in the industry and people I'd worked with in the past, it really moved me. I mean, it was incredible.
Dave, this is not really something that gets talked about, but because I have a lot of people who are in the profession, who want to get in the profession, who listen, I think it's just interesting. But when you go through something medical, what's the process of you alerting the people you work with? Do you immediately, like, when do you decide to call your bosses? How much do you decide to tell them? Because that's not, you know, there's no sort of training manual for that.
No, I know. Well, first of all, I couldn't really hide it. We were at the Blackhawks game with our family, and then I was going to drive from Chicago to East Lansing, and we were doing a pregame show before the Michigan-Michigan State game. on Saturday morning. So I was already planning kind of this crazy. We had had the Blackhawks thing planned for a long time. Then we decided to do the pregame. It's almost a 4-hour drive, but it's, you know, I really want to go. Kids were excited. They were each bringing a friend. And this thing hit kind of as we were at the Blackhawks game. Like, my face is numb, and saying to my wife, like, there's something crazy going on here. And we check, like, what are the symptoms of a stroke? We thought I was having a stroke, and I couldn't blink, but, you know, all this stuff. And once we figured out it wasn't that, and I said, you know, I think I'm okay. I've got to go. I mean, someone's got to host the show. So I actually left, like, after the second period and went. And kind of along the way, I noticed in the rearview mirror I wasn't blinking, and I pulled over and did a Google search and figured out it was Bell's palsy reasonably quickly. So I texted my bosses that night on the way and said, look, there's some weird thing going on with me. I think I'm okay to host the show, but it's weird. And I got to the arena, and they kind of said, all right, well, we'll do some stuff with the camera angles. We'll make sure not to take too many close-ups on you. It was really just kind of an interview show, and we had, you know, D'Antonio on and analysts and that kind of stuff. And so we were able to get through it, and I kind of had to tell them at that point, this is what I think it is. And, you know, got a confirmed diagnosis when I got back to Chicago, and then just sat down with my bosses, all of whom were unbelievable. I mean, just over-the-top great. And essentially said, look, I kind of said, you know, I don't really care, and I'll work. It doesn't matter. And they said, look, I think you need to just, you know, take a week or 2 weeks, and let's kind of see where this thing goes. And they were absolutely right. I mean, they kind of saved me from myself, frankly, because I'm a workaholic, and I have a passion for it, and I love it, and I didn't want to miss out on any of the season. And so, but they were great through the whole thing. They have continued to be incredibly supportive. But it is a really interesting question, right? And one of them said, one of our vice presidents said, you know, look, we can't keep you off the air. I mean, there's nothing in your contract that says you have to be able to move both sides of your mouth in order to be on the air. So you do what you need to do. But you know, we think this is kind of the best thing for you. But it was fascinating. She said she had never come across anything like this in her career of kind of dealing with an announcer with this situation. So very unusual.
Dave, you worked for ESPN for 10 years. And then in 2007, you announced that you were leaving ESPN for the Big Ten Network to be their lead studio host. ESPN wanted you to stay. You opted for this other offer. And obviously now 11 years later, it's turned out to be, I think, a great move for you, a great move for your family. But in 2007, there were no guarantees that, one, the Big Ten Network would be what it is today, and two, that you were also leaving a place at ESPN, and still obviously probably the destination place. But in 2007, I mean, it was truly kind of unheard of for some anchor to head from ESPN to a fledgling network. As you look back on this decision now, at what point in your Big Ten Network tenure did you realize for sure that you had made the right move? What was the point of what was the demarcation line at the Big Ten Network where you're like, you know what, maybe this was a gamble at first, but this really turned out to be the right thing for me?
Man, I would say, well, let me just back up a little bit if I could. I don't know that I ever really doubted, Richard, that it was the right move for me. I certainly got a lot of quizzical looks from some of my colleagues when it came out what I was going to be doing. I was going through a really weird time. As you say, ESPN had made a great offer for me to stay and made it very clear that they wanted me to be there. Personally, I was going through my father, who I was very, very close to, had been battling leukemia for 14 years and got to a point where it was obvious that he was not going to make it much longer. I felt like, even though ESPN had made it clear that they wanted me to stay, I felt like I had talked to a lot of my colleagues there who had just been through contract negotiations, people who were very well regarded at ESPN, and they told me, like, you need to have something else, man. You need to have another offer before you go into this negotiation, because they're just drawing a line in the sand, again, with really well regarded people, that this is going to be our offer, and they were taking money off the table with people. I think it was just kind of a phase they were going through of trying to control salaries and trying to continue to have the upper hand. And so a bunch of people told me, look, have some leverage. And so the BTN thing originally was honestly just a leverage play. I mean, I went to interview. I had no intention of taking the job, or I certainly didn't think I did. But then I met with the people in Chicago. It was very different from what I thought it was going to be. I didn't totally understand that it was going to be 24/7. I didn't understand the scope of the network. And then I met with the people. I met with Leon Schwire, who was the original EP, who I really liked, who subsequently left. But Mark Silverman blew me away. I mean, just an amazing guy. Jim Delaney, his vision for it, I thought was incredible. So once I went through that and then kind of cognizant of what was going on with my dad, they actually made me an offer. I hadn't told my parents what was going on. They made me an offer. And in that interim period, my father had to be put under sedation. And so he's alive when I got the offer. But I couldn't tell. I mean, I told him, but, you know, who knows, right? And he ended up passing away. And so he never knew, or at least I don't think he knew. And so that, it was just such a powerful moment, Richard, with all this stuff coming together and a really good feeling about the people at BTN and this feeling at ESPN that while I loved it, and I really did love it, I'm not one of those people who left with any bitterness or rancor. They were great. They said, well, there'll always be a spot for you here. Not, I don't know whether there still is, but, but, you know, at the time it seemed like the right thing to say. They were incredibly supportive again just a few weeks ago. So I left a great place, but I never really doubted that BTN was going to work or that it was the right thing for me. So I don't know that there was that point. I mean, that's a long way of saying I don't think I ever really doubted it. There was this strange thing when I got there with the distribution battle, which I did not anticipate. I asked every question in the book except for, are we going to be on the air? Like, I just thought that was kind of basic. And it came out very soon after I agreed that there was this big distribution battle and that we may not be on the major cable carriers. So that first year, you had some consternation, but I always felt like it was the right move for me.
Dave, what kind of calculus did you make in your mind about being a really prominent, if not the most prominent, anchor at a place which is smaller versus being part of a rotation at the most famous place in the world in sports broadcasting? Was that because there'll be others who would be in a similar kind of position? What was your calculus on those two kind of tent poles?
That was really important to me, I have to say. There, ESPN, while it was great, unless you're one of the very top guys, I think you always feel, I felt like month to month, when that schedule came out for every month, you're kind of like, okay, where do I stand? And constantly assessing, because at that time in particular, there wasn't a talent office. No one gave you feedback. I think it has changed, and I think a lot for the better from what I've heard. But you were just kind of out there trying to figure out, what do these people think of me? Who are the important people in my future? And for me in particular, I guess, like, that life in the gray was challenging. It's kind of a hard way to live. And I was kind of a master, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, right? Where, so your schedule's all over the place. I mean, I vividly remember in that last month having a week where I had the late night sports center, the 1 a.m., 2 a.m. on a Thursday. And so you get home at like 4 in the morning. And then I had the Sports Center AM on Saturday morning, where you get in at like 5 o'clock in the morning. So I got home at like 4 o'clock in the morning Friday. And between then and 5 o'clock in the morning Saturday, I was supposed to get two nights of sleep and write the Saturday morning show. It just felt like I had young kids, and it just felt like, what am I doing? Like, when am I going to know kind of what my place is? Even though I was getting, those are both good assignments. Those are good shows. But it just felt like, okay, you know, here was something where they were offering me to be the main guy, which I'd never been in my career, and that was appealing. And then, you know, more play-by-play. I'd started doing play-by-play at ESPN, which, again, was something that very few guys got to do. I mean, I was really in a great position there to be able to do that, but here was going to be Big Ten games rather than, you know, Conference USA or the West Coast Conference, and that was really appealing. So there was a lot of stuff, I think, that came together that just made me feel like this was the league I'd grown up following. It's college sports, which is my passion. It was a chance to be the lead guy. So I think to be the lead guy somewhere else, I might not have made the same decision. It was what I was covering as the lead guy and where it was going to be and the people I was working for that made it really appealing.
Dave, you've been asked this question or a form of this question a million times, but for the purpose of this podcast, obviously, I think it's interesting to people. The Big Ten schools have an equity share in the Big Ten network. So how do you navigate that financial arrangement while discussing potentially difficult topics, whether it's alleged criminality at Michigan State to, you know, whatever, to obviously this major college basketball scandal, not necessarily existing in the Big Ten, but existing at schools around the country, where it just sort of gets into some places that are newsworthy, but obviously not always probably stuff conferences want discussed in full.
Great question, and one that has been a huge part of our evolution. One of the questions I remember asking Jim Delaney when we had dinner was, how are we going to cover challenging stories? And his line was essentially, look, we have to cover them. And if people are going elsewhere for Big Ten news, then we have failed as a network. So it is going to be our mission to cover those stories. We're not looking to uncover them. I mean, we're not actively seeking out. We're not, you know, again, to be a full-fledged news-gathering organization with an investigative team, I mean, in the way that ESPN is, I mean, that's just not our mission. It's not who we are. So, and then as you mentioned, obviously you have an equity, the schools have an equity share. I mean, it's just not, that's just not how it's constructed. And for anyone to think that that was how it's going to work, again, you don't understand the business. But we do have to cover those things. I mean, I think the onus is on us to do that. And we've had varying levels of success. I mean, honestly, the Penn State story, we did not handle well. We were kind of frozen at the beginning. We didn't know what to do. We were kind of waiting for a comment from the school that never came. I mean, there was so much other stuff going on. And for the first few days, I'd say the first couple of days, I think we blew it. I don't think we did a good job, and we were criticized for it. And I do think that we learned a significant amount from that. The Michigan State story, I think we've done much better. It is our job to cover that. It is our job occasionally to opine on that. But it's, again, not our job to uncover it. And I feel like we found that good balance where we absolutely report the stories. We will bring on other journalists to talk about what's going on. And I think that does justice to the story. And, you know, I feel really good about the way, as you mentioned, I mean, there's some big stuff going down this year. It's been crazy, and certainly have strong opinions about what's happening in the world of college basketball. And you know, maybe we get into that. But yeah, I feel like we found a balance, but it's not easy. And we were the first ones to do this, right? We're the first ones with the conference network. And so it was uncharted territory.
Dave, you know, one of the interesting things about the Big Ten, as we're talking, because you're in New York, is the Big Ten basketball tournament is at the Garden. Big Ten Network has the games through the quarters, which is huge for the network, obviously, especially the quarterfinal round. I mean, that's stuff you usually expect on CBS or ESPN. But how at least from when you are hearing from viewers or consumers of the network, are they pleased that the tournament is in New York City, or is there blowback in terms of, you know, this should be at in a quote unquote Big Ten city?
It's divided, Richard. There is certainly a group of fans that believe that the game should always be in the Midwest, and the Midwest is the traditional epicenter of the league, and have them in Chicago or have them in Indianapolis. And I do get that. But I feel like if you're going to have these other schools, if you're going to try to broaden the scope of your league, how can you have these schools in the league and not at some point bring the tournament somewhere near them? I mean, they have to feel like they're included. And so I absolutely get the calculus of why it's here in New York. I mean, New York in particular, there are so many Big Ten alums here. As you well know, I mean, a ton of Michigan fans in Wisconsin and Indiana. And so I think even above and beyond the Eastern schools, which will have fan bases here, I think that this is going to be a great scene here at the Garden. The first day is always, you know, no matter where it is, Chicago, Indy, it's not always all that well attended. But by the time we get into Thursday, Friday, and the weekend, I think it's going to be fabulous. And to play in Madison Square Garden is such a, I mean, you know, it's the epicenter of sports in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a mecca of athletic history in the United States. And so I think it's an incredible opportunity for these kids. I think it's great for the fan base. I think if they did it too often, I'm not sure it would be great for the league, but the next four are in the Midwest, and I think people who come here are going to have an amazing experience.
Right, a couple more here, Dave. Obviously, we got a couple questions for you from readers when I put out there that you were going to be on the podcast. So this is sort of a variation of this, but you have traveled to the Big Ten campuses, and I think you have a good sense of what the game day environment is like at each Big Ten school. If for people who are listening to this across the country who have never attended, let's say, a Big Ten football game, what would you say, you know, in the way that a lot of people, if you ask that question to the SEC, they would say, you got to go to a night game at Death Valley. You got to go see the Iron Bowl at either Auburn or Alabama. Are there three or four that you would say to really understand what the Big Ten is about that you would recommend in terms of game day environments?
Yeah, I would start at Ohio State. When you sit there and watch Script Ohio unfold in front of you and you hear people come to the crescendo building as people get excited about that, there's very few scenes I've ever seen in college football. And I've been, you know, I hosted the College Game Day radio show when I was at ESPN and traveled around the country for 6 years with Mel Kiper and then with McShay and DiNardo. So, I mean, I've been to a lot of these SEC games, and that is right there. I mean, it's as good, if not better. It's an amazing scene. Camp Randall's incredible. Madison is just such a great town, wonderful setting for a university. And when the jump around starts going and the press box is shaking and you are convinced that it's going to fall off of its moorings, that's a pretty special experience. Whiteout at Happy Valley is amazing. So I'd say that would be where I would start. But you know, the tailgating scene's great. I just think there's such a passion for these schools. The state universities in the Midwest are such an important part of the fabric of each of these states. And to really understand them, to understand Nebraska, going to a Nebraska football game is part of that experience, to understand how the population and the fan base think. You know, Iowa, the same thing. I mean, these schools don't just represent the university and the students, they represent the states. And I think that's part of what makes it very special.
Dave, there are a lot of high-profile coaches, football coaches in this conference. Urban Meyer, Jim Harbaugh, Kirk Ferentz, James Franklin, Mark D'Antonio, you know, there are others, Pat Fitzgerald, et cetera. How would you, these are some of obviously the most well-known names in the country, how would you assess the access that these particular college football coach give your staff, your reporters? Do you find that they are really, really accessible, or will they push back sometimes at your request, even though you are the league-owned network?
Well, it varies from school to school, but I think that we have built equity over the years with each of these schools where they kind of understand what we're trying to do. One of our biggest initiatives starting our second year was this preseason bus tour that Jerry DiNardo and Howard Griffith and I take, where we go to every school, we film a practice, they give us access to the practice, and we talk to the players and coaches as a means of previewing the season. And we're gone for 17 or 18 days at a time. And it's really fun. I mean, I like those guys a lot. And, you know, they've been with us from the very beginning. And so it's something I look forward to every year. But you build a rapport and you build an understanding that, hey, we're not going to try to burn anybody here. We're not going to show video that you don't want out there, because there are things that happen in a preseason practice that you don't want the opposing coaches to see. And so you tell us what those things are, and we will certainly make sure those things don't appear on the air. But the level of cooperation has been great. I mean, we have a rapport with the coaches. They get us, we get them. They, you know, a lot of them kind of ask about family and that type of thing. I had a lot of coaches reach out to me during my health issues. So I think we struck a good balance. I think there was suspicion at first, Richard, because they didn't kind of understand us, because again, it was something that no other league had that they had never dealt with. But I feel like we forged a good understanding here. And again, it's different from place to place, but we very rarely get no's. We get a, well, what if we did it this way? And I think that's fair. It's their program. We're the guests here.
Two more for me, Dave. Something that's really interesting to me is, and maybe it's not really, I don't know if the word is unfair. Maybe this question would exist for anybody who works at a singular place for a long time. But as you head forward in your Big Ten Network career, and you get to be there 15 years or 20 years, what do you want to do to sort of keep the keep the job fresh, or I realize you should, I'm breaking the John Sawatsky rule of asking a long question.
Yeah, so double-barrel question.
Right, double barrel. Comma, or is it fresh just because the content changes every year because there are new players, new coaches, new teams, et cetera?
Well, I mean, part of what I've done to keep it fresh is work on outside projects. Now, I spent 4 years writing a book, The Opening Kickoff.
Yep. Well, that was going to be my last question, so keep going.
Okay. So, that was on the history of college football, basically focusing on a 25-year period between about 1890 and 1915, and talking about how the game evolved and why it became so popular, telling it through the story largely of this player at Wisconsin named Pat O'Day. And it, you know, it did great. I mean, I was thrilled, made the New York Times bestseller list, which was incredibly cool. I mean, one of the neatest things that's ever happened to me. But I immersed myself in it for 4 years, Richard. I mean, I spent my off season in libraries and archives and reading through newspapers that are 125 years old. And so that was amazing for me, and I'm hoping that there might be some other projects kind of on sports history. We're coming up on the 150th anniversary of the first college football game, so I'm kind of looking into some possibilities of how I might be able to be involved in that. I'm interested in other things, and the schedule that we have at BTN gives me some downtime in the summer to, A, be more with my family and all of those things that are incredibly important to me, but also to explore other interests. And so I feel like I haven't gotten burned out or felt like I'm not being challenged. And the network has evolved, and I've had a really big role in that, and there are a lot of opportunities to give input about where we should go and what we might do differently. We took our pregame show on campus these last couple of years, BTN tailgate show. So that's different. So you've got something that's new there. Taking on a little bit more play-by-play responsibility through the years, which I really like. So I feel like between exploring other options and then, as you said, it does evolve and it changes and there are new figures, there are new schools. All of that stuff keeps it fresh for me. So I have not gotten to any point where I felt like I'm burned out or this isn't the right fit. I come to work invigorated every day, and I just love it. I mean, I feel so fortunate after starting my career in a field which I was totally uninterested in as a banker to be doing what I'm doing.
And then the last one for me is you just referenced this before. Your book, The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation, was indeed a New York Times bestseller. If you go on Amazon, you see reviews from publications that really praised it, and you know whether it's the Wall Street Journal or Boston Globe or Sports Illustrated. So this wasn't, and I don't know, I really am not sort of trying to be a wise ass here. This was not like a broadcaster just doing a quick book to try to make a buck. You know, this was a writer writing a book who happens to be in broadcasting. So my thought was that this really potentially, Dave, seems like a place where you could do multiple books given your love of history. Have you gotten to the point yet where you want to do something in the next couple of years? You don't have to mention the idea per se, but
right.
I would have to think, just given the success of the book, given that you got a lot of praise just based on the research and the quality of the writing, that there has to be at least one other book in you.
Well, I will say this. It was the hardest thing I have ever done by a multiple that I couldn't even begin to calculate. It was really hard. I mean, as I said, you know, it's a 4-year process. It was a real grind. I liken it to starting it and putting out the proposal, and I kind of seem like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this. This would be great. I have a really good story here, and it's never been told. I liken it to kind of getting to the starting line of a marathon, and you happen to have on some running shoes and shorts, and you say, oh, these guys are going for a run. Maybe I'll go with them. And you kind of have no idea what you've gotten yourself into. And then I sold the book, and here's the deadline. It's like, oh, my goodness. What have I done here? This is craziness. So it was daunting. And I probably don't need to tell you this as one who has spent time as a journalist. You know, the payback financially wasn't necessarily the most overwhelming
exactly. Yep.
in the world. So, but again, I mean, that certainly wasn't why I did it. But again, I mean, it would have to be exactly the right project. It would probably have to be after my kids. I've got a sophomore in high school and 2 7th graders. And I think it would probably have to be after they're out of the house. It really took over a few summers, and I felt bad that I missed out on some family time, and we're on a family vacation, and I had like 60 pages of footnotes, and my footnotes were due. And right. So we're on a family vacation. I had to allocate every morning to footnotes. Like, that's kind of no way to have a family vacation. So I would have to, now that I know what I know, I mean, I think I could do it differently. I loved the process. I love writing. I mean, I really absolutely love it. I love piecing this story together, telling a story that people didn't know, and kind of making these parallels between college athletics now and then. I mean, you know, the scandal that's going on right now has so many antecedents in that time period. None of this is new. And to make those connections, to connect those dots was so rewarding. And the reviews do matter. Like, you could say, oh, that stuff doesn't matter to me. Richard, that mattered.
Right.
There's, I don't think there's an author. Maybe there's an author out there who has more self-confidence than I do, or you know, doesn't care what people think. I cared what people thought. And to see that review in the Wall Street Journal, like, that meant a lot. Boston Globe, Chicago, all those places. It matters. And it was so gratifying because it was hard. So knowing how hard it was, I don't know that I'm rushing to do another one. But at some point, someday, maybe there is something else out there. I definitely would never say never. And I loved the process. I loved the final result. I just, the time was challenging.
Dave Refson is the lead host of the Big Ten Network. The Big Ten Network this week is in New York City for the Big Ten tournament this year. They have the quarterfinals before CBS takes over. Dave, it's great to hear that your health is back on the right track. People can watch and continue to watch you on the Big Ten Network. And it's obviously just a growing network, major success story in that space. Dave Refson, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
An honor. Thanks so much for having me, Richard. Again, congratulations to you.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Adnan Virk of ESPN and Dave Refson of the Big Ten Network. Both interesting guys, and you can obviously follow their work at their respective outlets. The previous podcast guest before that, Carrie Champion of ESPN, really honest stuff on her interview with LeBron James and Kevin Durant and being a high-profile African-American woman, I should say, in sports broadcasting. Check out all the previous Sports Illustrated Media podcasts on Apple Podcasts. If you like the content, please give us a review. For producer Lou Pellegrino, for Cadence 13, for Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.